Hello, and welcome to recording number 19 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 15th, 2021. Just before this, where we start off, Gord and Geller and Gord, Geller, and Greenleaf and Inkosi, Patrick and Moon are the last six left out of their band, and they've chased down Obmi's raiders. Now, Obmi had left, and it was Gleed the Gnome in charge, and they had fought Melf, and the remainder of the bandits had escaped with their prisoners, these women taken for slave trading. Now, Gord and Geller and Greenleaf, they go and they catch up to them. They catch them in a small woods, and after they defeat them, Gord is able to see with some kind of magical vision this cloud, a black swirling mass of an ebon cloud that is coming toward them. And so they see that there's the Hierarchs are in there riding night gaunts. There's hordes of hobgoblins and bats and crows, and it's a huge mass. But they also know that, get the sense that there's a foe that these creatures are going against, and even more powerful one, and that would be Melf and Chert and Lizard and Biff, who had defeated Gleed. Now they have to face this terror from Hades. And so they send Patrick and Moon away, because they're just these mercenaries who joined them and felt that they owed Geller and Greenleaf. And they're not up to the same strength, the heroic strength of the other four. So Patrick and Moon have left with the women, take them to safety. And Geller and Gord, Greenleaf, and Inkosi, the Flan warrior, are now riding to try to get to the aid of, they don't know who, but it's actually Melf and Chert. So I'm going to start right here. It is page 181 and the final paragraph. He rubbed his hand across his face unconsciously. A tiny spark of light shot from his hand to his eye. A glimmering of starshine caught and reflected from the cat's eye chiriso barrel of his ring. With that glint came a jolt of memory. He reached into his pouch, a magical case that could contain far more material than its outer dimensions would suggest. Gord recalled a parchment scroll taken from the vampiric Plincourt some time back when he had plied his craft in the byways of Greyhawk. Pardon me. He had tucked it away and forgotten it for several reasons. Perhaps this was something he could use. "What are you rummaging for?" asked Inkosi, awe in his voice as he noticed a foot of Gord's arm buried within a pouch no more than 6 inches deep. The young thief dug deeper still, saying, "Some small tool to confuse the enemy, I hope." "Oh," said the Flan soldier, noncommittedly, still eyeing the pouch. Gord ignored his stare and soon found the roll of thick stuff he sought. Before drawing it carefully forth, he looped reins around Cantle so as to have both hands free. Unrolling it cautiously, Gord peered at the writings that he discerned clearly despite the faint illumination. All right, break. Now, we have that cat's eye ring pop up. It's been a while. And all through Saga of the Old City, it is this item that Gord has had. It's kind of questionable. I believe it's what Lita had referred to as his, you know, one thing from his parents and showing something from his past. But it's never directly said, and it's very confusing as how Gord has where he recovered it and how he has maintained his hold on it. As a child, he was taken to the workhouse. So anyway, here the cat's eye, it was promised at the end of Saga of Old City that the cat's eye ring would play a part further down the road. So here we have it coming up again. We also have mention of some side adventure that has not been detailed. Gord recalled a parchment scroll taken from the vampiric Plincourt some time back. Now, I assume Plincourt is actually a name, but it could be a place. The connotation isn't there to really give you enough detail to decide if it's a person, place, or even some kind of thing. It's vampiric, but I don't know exactly what Plincourt is at this point. And I don't believe it was ever mentioned before. All right, now the other thing is Gord here has somehow come across some kind of pouch of holding where he can, you know, put far more into it than its mere small dimensions would, you know, allow if it weren't some fairly powerful magic item, and obviously something that the Flan warrior is a little taken aback at in Kosi here. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 161, and it is paragraph 6. The page was covered in magical ideograms, interspersed with certain arcane signs and sigils, surrounding a cryptic diagram and runic grid of power. Gord breathed a great sigh of relief, for the thing contained neither trap nor curse. It was a recondite writing of great power. After puzzling over the page for several minutes, the young adventurer looked up with his face wreathed in a smile. "This scroll I hold is a work of marvelous fortuity," he cried to his comrades. "This holds the key to deal with that unnameable one. It is a banishment." The others reined in, and Curly Greenleaf came near to Gord. "I am no demon crafter, but I will examine that parchment if I may, Gord." Gord agreed readily, handing the crinkly scroll to the half-elf. Greenleaf peered intently, saying, "Not so fast, my friends. I can make out but little of this stuff, but this I do know. The spell writ herein is aimed at stuff of evil, but is most puissant when used against those of negative plane power." There was no sense disputing the words of the druid, for he knew the symbols of the nine alignments as surely as any Cassock priest. "Tell me how you came to possess this scroll," Geller said urgently. Gord complied, briefly relating a strange encounter in a strange place. Then the young thief said to his comrade, "We learned the extent of our folly, for many unexpected and unpleasant things befell us thereafter." "Still," Gord said reflectively, "this may be reward, and more for what was lost." "Perhaps," the bard said slowly, "but be not over quick to rely on it. You yourself, Gord, are worth more than even the greatest of spells when danger must be faced. The one we must oppose is a malign and powerful being, but he is not so all-powerful as you might attribute," avowed the druid a little peevishly. "What is our situation now, damn it?" growled Nkosi. "Are we stopping or riding? Talking? What?" Gord grinned at the dark warrior, for his point was well taken. "We're riding, Nkosi," said the bard, "but we are better prepared now than before." "Not a moment too soon either," Greenleaf interjected. "Look!" Ahead and just a little to the right, a strange shimmering plane suddenly lit up the sky. A dark, bulky form struck the plane of luminousness. Sorry there. And a soul-wrenching shriek followed as the deep bellow reverberated. The plane of life fell away in coruscating shards that dimmed and went out before they touched the ground. Even as this occurred, a second and then a third of the planes appeared before the great blob of utter darkness. All right, break. So what's being described here is Melf's walls of force that he's casting from his wand. So that is the verbal description of what is happening and how the demonic creature is dispelling them very quickly and moving forward. Now, this business with the scroll, I find you know, it's just so opportune that I kind of give a groan at it. It reminds me of how Gygax had Gord just recently, you know, fell the rider of the Green Dragon with his Sling Stone. I'm a little sorry to see these you know, kind of contrived heroics. It just strikes me. I may be wrong. Maybe this scroll will not work, but just to be able to pull a banishment scroll out of your pouch, it just seems to me to it's too fortuitous, and I really don't know why Gygax didn't sit down. He had so many great ideas that I find these just so convenient. It was completely unnecessary back over the Sus Forest for Gord to have needed to throw the dragon off course, since the dragon, from his description, could never have caught up with them in the Chariot of Sestar. Now, with this, again, it's just, I was thinking that my, you know, I don't know if these guys are powerful enough as far as the game mechanics go. Chris pointed out that in yesterday's recording 17, that the leader of the Herrick, of the Horns, leading Herrick of the Horn Society, is an 18th level cleric. And the 18th level cleric, plus riding upon this gigantic creature from Hades, I thought might be a bit much, even for, you know, Curly, who seems to be one of the higher level characters, and I don't think he's like more than 14th, so it would be a very interesting battle. But if this banishment actually does work, I just think it would have been much better if it was something that you know, Geller or Curly had along and had known that they would be maybe facing you know, some terrible kind of devilish or demonic creature, and they had that, you know, prepared for it, especially when they knew they were going after the artifact of evil, and it had previously been guarded by a Catablone demon, not the artifact, but the relic that was used to detect the artifact. So I wouldn't be surprised if Curly or Geller had been able to, you know, pull that out and use it as a desperate thing, but that they were provided for. But just Gord being able to have that on him by happenstance is unfortunate, I think. I don't think that's a very good bit of writing right there. All right. Now, if I had Chris along today, I'd be seeing the banishment spell pop up in the fiction text here. But so just today, I'm going to have to go by memory of various things. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 183. And it is the fifth paragraph from the bottom. Not a moment too soon either, Greenleaf interjected. Look. Ahead and just a little to the right, a strange shimmering plane lit up the sky. A dark, bulky form struck the plane of luminousness, and a soul-wrenching shriek followed. As the deep bellow reverberated, the plane of light fell away in coruscating shards that dimmed and went out before they touched the ground. Even as this occurred, a second and then a third of the planes appeared before the great blob of utter darkness. It is the great Daemonkin and its master, cried Gord, as he kicked his horse into a run. They have come for the souls of those in the grove ahead. The other three quickly followed, and in a minute all were streaming toward the stand of trees a few hundred yards distant. They were almost to the copse when the last of the planes of phosphorescent force broke, and a wave of terror struck them as a mighty breaker washes the shore. Gord vaulted out of his saddle. The near palpable fear that swirled around him had no effect upon his mind, but his horse was terrified and uncontrollable. Rather than try to fight the creature's panic and waste valuable seconds, the young thief abandoned the beast to its fate. He hit the ground running, and in a dozen strides reached the grove. The druid used his power to soothe and quiet his steed, and Geller, likewise skilled in the arts of nature, used similar powers to do the same for his horse. Both adventurers were as heedless as Gord was of the mindless panic radiating from the horror from the depths of Hades. The projected terror simply had no effect upon either Greenleaf or the bard, but not so in Kosi. First there was a moment of frozen struggle, during which the Flan warrior locked his mind upon his mission and denied all fear. His courser was rigid beneath him, Inkosi's legs holding its barrel in a vice-like grip. Then the horse screamed, reared, and came down with its legs madly pumping. Perhaps it was his effort to keep his seat and control the animal. Perhaps not. Whatever the cause, Inkosi was suddenly as crazed with panic as the horse that bore him. Man and animal, both crazed and screaming, went into the night. Just as he was about to plunge in among the trees, Gord heard voices. The steeds of four riders were moving away from the copse, the horses running in reckless abandon, but under control of those who rode them. Gord shouted a curse of frustration and ran southwest after the horsemen. A groaning of awful aspect nearly deafened him from the monstrous flying daemon buffeted the ground beneath as the wind from the monster. He smelled a terrible stench, felt an ache in every nerve in his body, and then the utter blackness was gone from above Gord's head. Despite himself, the young adventurer looked up and saw the true forms of steed and master. Retching and spitting bile, Gord stumbled on. He could see the distant figures of dismounted men. One must be a gnome or halfling from its size. He knew, preparing to make a stand against the horror approaching them. Hooves pounded behind him. "Now, Gord," shouted Geller as he and Greenleaf stopped their horses. "If you ever read Quickly and True, do so now. The scroll, use it." "I know not the names of daemon or rider," Gord shouted in reply as he readied the parchment. "The master of the thing is Nerl himself," Geller said as he dismounted, "and the daemon is called Hutripitok, true name or not. Call upon any names your heart knows as inimical to those of evil." Curly Greenleaf added desperately as he himself prepared to unleash his own spells. "Neither of us can aid you now," he said. And the druid turned to face the lightless mass that besmirched the ground but 100 paces distant. All right, break. Well, that is a surprise for me, and I've read this several times, but I'd certainly forgotten that Nerl is the head of the leading hierarch of the Horn Society. I just wonder if he's an avatar or whether the leading hierarch can be possessed by Nerl, but it's surprising. As Nerl is the Flan god of death, that I don't believe he could be in himself here on Earth, and it would have to be some kind of avatar, though this is Gygax's version of the setting, but there is a powerful daemon named Putripitok. So, you know, here is very handy for that banishment, but again, I mean, Nerl is a full deity, so I can't imagine that just the characters being able to deal with him, and even his avatar would be, you know, a serious, serious problem. All right, now poor Inkosi has been hit by the fear spell, and as Gygax showed, Gord's horse, the horses of Geller, the course of Inkosi and then Inkosi himself have now fled in panic. I believe that was the horses of Melf and Lizard and Chert and Biff who have run out of the trees that Gord saw initially. Okay, but if The leader of the Horns, leading Herrick, is actually Narrow. That is quite something I hadn't noted down before. So that should be, I'm going to have to really look into to see if it's confirmed in any other places. As I had thought, and as Chris had mentioned, it was supposed to be an 18th level cleric. All right. I am going to restart. It's page 185 and the second paragraph. As his comrades began to work what spells they could to bring woe to such fell adversaries, Gord could not refrain from glancing quickly at the scene before him. His extraordinary new vision enabled him to see clearly, but he focused on the four men being held at bay, not upon the nauseating pair who attacked them. One of those he saw was a giant of a man hefting a huge axe. Gord nearly started and dropped the precious scroll. That was Chert. His mind screamed at him to run, to stand and die fighting at his friend's side, but reason held Gord in check. Rays and bolts of unnameable colors were playing upon the ghastly figure and its murderous mount, as quarrels and sling bullets flew at them. Gord heard the one called the Reaper give vent to peals of sepulchral laughter at these efforts, and the evil rider spoke in a hellish voice. "Now I claim you all for my flock, Nigglings," Narrow boomed as he flew from the huge winged daemon thing. "Your souls and the second key shall be my gifts to he who will awaken." This Gord heard, but he was unmindful of the meaning. Neither did he think of the beast or of Narrow's scythe. Gord had begun to read the twisting and writhing lines inscribed on the sheet of ancient parchment. All right, so I'm breaking right here, and it is really surprising to me, like I had just mentioned, that Gygax is having Narrow as the head of the Hierarchs of the Horn Society. But definitely that's what he's saying. He's not saying that it is a man who has taken on the form of Narrow, or that possessed by the spirit or anything. This is, from what Gygax is saying, it seems to be Narrow himself, and it is a big shock. Now, the other thing, and what's really worth mentioning here, is that Narrow is saying that, he is going to kind of bow down before Tharaston. So, that is a bit of a surprise there, that, Narrow, but then just, encountering Narrow right here is a big shock. All right. I am going to restart. All right. Well, there's a little bit here. Gord has this true vision. I don't know if it's coming because of his cat's eye ring or not. There wasn't more than just a little mention, but he has now recognized Chert, and it shows that his, besides other flaws, his qualities are that he immediately, his first thought was to go and stand and fight beside his friend, even if it meant dying beside him, which was a very admirable quality right there from Gord. All right. And you can see that the various spells are having no effect, or seemingly no effect, upon Narrow or his mount, this great demon, Daemon. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 185. And it is the third paragraph from the end. If the rider was impervious to the attacks of the beleaguered party, not so the daemon Triptok. It was stung by the spells and missiles. It lunged its titanic bulk forward, furious at the affront and ravening to crush and tear and devour those who dared to hurt him so. This fury saved the four defenders, for the monster's rush prevented the Reaper from plying his weapon. Be still, Nero commanded the winged Behemoth. The thing felt the searing pain of the scythe, though the contact was a mere touch. Cowed, Kutripitok drew back and huddled its bulk upon itself. Then Nero stepped to the fore. All the while, Gord had been reciting, the near unpronounceable words of the banishment spell. His eyes burned and his tongue felt as if it were possessed by a serpent. Beads of sweat sprang from his forehead and ran into his eyes, while his hands shook and water seemed to fill his knees. He invoked the names of the deities Celestian and Farlangan and Rao from dimly remembered prayers of childhood, as the text demanded that beings of power be called upon. Gord tried to shout forth the spell, but his mouth was dry and his voice cracked, and the words seemed to be mere croakings and guttural, meaningless mumblings to his straining ears. This takes an eternity. You're too late, one part of the young thief's mind babbled. Somehow he ignored the thought and read the scroll to its finish. The conclusion nearly gagged him. His throat was so raw, and the words brought agony to Gord's whole being. Elohim, Zeter Maldisla, Adonai, Rexphilus. Gord shouted at the conclusion, adding the name of the cat lord for good measure, for it seemed that one had certainly aided him in his quest. All right, break. Now, I'm assuming here, now one thing we get is this banishment spell and how difficult it is for Gord to even pronounce his way through it, but more interesting are these names. Now, we know Rexphilus, you know, the cat lord, but we're given three other names here. Elohim, Zeter, Medelsa, and Adonai. Now, it seems that these are probably deities or extremely powerful, creatures. Like I said, that Gord was calling on Celestian, Farlangan, and Rao, and here he is calling on these. And I think there may be just name drops right here, because none of them are familiar to me. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 186 and the third paragraph from the bottom. A colorless sheet of nothingness descended before Gord's eyes. His mind closed upon itself and went blank. A terrible wail spread outward from Nero. The demon beast took up the sound, and it became a groaning bellow that echoed and rebounded upon hill and plain, over meadow and marsh, piercing woodland and valley for a league, and was even faintly heard in Kribalsthorpe, a score of miles away. The earth was blasted from the spot as thunder boomed and lightning beat a frenzied tattoo round about, while tornadic winds howled and roared so that no vegetation within a mile stood whole, and green when their work was finished. Rocks split and smoke shot from great fissures. Flames sprang from the very air to whirl and dance and consume. But even these ravening tongues were whipped and shredded to nothingness by the fury of the whirlwinds. There was a clap of sound as if iron had been slammed upon iron by two angry giants. And then there was nothing save the scoured, ruined land. Break. That is the end of chapter 16. So, we're given a couple things. Now, Chris is here, and he has added the Nero's, description here. He's a major deity, but he does have an avatar. Now, it is very interesting to me then that Nero, I would say it would have to be his avatar, that Nero's avatar is the leader of the Horn Society. So, I didn't think that was what it was going to be, that he was actually the leader of the Horn Society. So perhaps the cleric who is listed as listed as the leader is actually Narrow masquerading, or Narrow's avatar masquerading.
But that was from the folio, and it said reportedly, but who knows?
Yeah, so it really surprised me when all of a sudden Gord sees into this, and he actually sees that it's Narrow.
I didn't remember that at all.
Well, I remember Narrow being involved with this, but not him being supposed to be the leader of the Horn Society. And it makes me wonder, boy, yeah, of course he's going to be in contention with us. Because, he's a major deity. He's actually, that's why I don't think he could possibly be actually on this plane rather than an avatar. Because it was always supposed to be that us was so powerful because everybody, all the other deities had, were not breaking this thing where they came to Earth. And at most they had an avatar show up. So, I would assume that something like that would have to be true because Narrow's just too... And for them to have any chance at all, it just seems impossible that they're going against Narrow and that they'd have any chance. Now, you came in after this business, but Gord reads this spell of banishment. And he just happens to remember having a scroll from an encounter in Greyhawk that we hadn't heard about before with a vampire, or something that he referred that I think maybe this thing or person called Plincourt. And he got this scroll out of it, and he reaches into a pouch of holding, pulls out the scroll, and the scroll's a banishment scroll. And I just found that he just made me groan. It was just like... here we are again with Gord, pulling out the, do ex machina there ending where, there's no possible way, it's like a Flash Gordon thing. There's no possible way. And then, Gord happens to have a banishment spell powerful enough to dispel Narrow. I mean, it seems
unlikely.
It's shockingly poor writing. I thought very, because Gygax is better than this. It's just, this really was like, their bacon got saved at the last minute by a completely, ridiculous, it wasn't fortuitous, like he said, it was ridiculous. Because, he just happens to have this incredibly powerful, scroll. Now I did like the fact that the ring, the cat's eye ring, does seem to be coming into power now, and Gord has suddenly gained the ability. He could see into this swirling ebon mist that was obscuring everything, and see exactly what was hidden.
Yeah, I remember some of. That from yesterday, and I was right,
so
okay.
They don't mention it directly as cause and effect, but I was pointing out how Gygax had promised at the end of Saga of Old City that we'd hear more about the ring. The ring was always coming up, and here it's mentioned again, and it's mentioned that Gord could see all this without touching his sword.
Okay.
So, and he noticed this glint coming from the cat's eye ring, so I'm pretty sure his vision. And so all this here, I do like this business and these undefined names right here. I like the little hint that there was some kind of adventure in Greyhawk that wasn't mentioned before, probably with him and Chert. Might be even be in Knight Errant. I don't know. But here, there's a little mention, but I did not like... I didn't like back when he used the Sling Stone against the Rider of the Green Dragon, and I don't like this business right here. That is very lazy writing. It's very lazy, and it didn't have to be. I don't understand why he made creatures so ridiculously powerful. And
there's no need for it. I mean, they don't need to be facing gods in the second book.
No, and then you know, there's that, and then it just, you know, this whole chase thing to end with just suddenly Gord pulls out, you know, a MacGuffin, and, you know, voila. Just, you know, yeah, and then voila, he's banished a major deity or its avatar and a major daemon, just at the right time, just at the last second, and it's just, you know, I mean, that really is poor writing there. I'm sorry, I love a lot of stuff that Gygax does in this, and I've enjoyed the story much more than I did for a long time, you know, reading it out here, but I really do find that banishment scroll to be just too perfect, and, you know, it just seems absolutely unnecessary. It would have been a much better story if there was a fight against, you know, originally there was only one Hierarch, and then suddenly there's the leader and two other Hierarchs, and the leader's narrow, and they could just have kept it to where it was a fight against a demon. You know, that would have been enough for these guys right here, you know, to go up against, and I don't know why it was turned up to this level at this point, you know. Anyway, I was hoping for a good fight scene at the end. He's got a good description of what's happening here. Once the banishment goes out, how powerful it is, that it ruins the whole section of Furiondi right here, that they're in, I don't know how wide. But then, the only last thing is there's this town, Krabelsthorpe, which is mentioned a score of miles away from this point right here. So,
Furiondi?
I'm sorry?
Is it in Furiondi?
Yes, it should be. Because they've been backpedaling ever since they saw the approach of the creatures from the Hierarch. They never got... Melf crossed the River Vang, and then he came back and told them about what was there. Then they ambushed the Gleed and the rest of the Obni's band on the Furiondi side of the Vang, and then they ran for it, you know, after they noticed this ebon cloud coming for them.
And so they had that vision of something evil.
Yeah, and but I mean, that was Melf, you know, who would have been running for it. And then after, you know, then we get this business about Gord and Geller and Curly and such, finding that tail end with a few bandits and the slave girls and stuff. So, you know, there's that, and then there's the re-encounter, because they even describe here when Melf is casting the walls of force and the creature and Narrow are going through them one after another. And that's when the two groups are just about to meet. You know, and that's at the last moment Gord whips out that banishment spell, you know, so.
Kind of crazy that the Hierarchs of the Horned Society have invaded Furiondi.
Yeah, and I that would have been enough. I mean, that would have been a plenty of story right there. And maybe they could have killed off a demon. Maybe they could have even killed off a Hierarch. But, you know, Narrow, that just knocked this way out of the park for me.
I do remember some discussion of a cult of Narrow from City of Hawks. I don't remember specifics. But that's one of the things. I remember almost nothing of this book, but I do remember that coming up in the future.
I think I remember that as well. But then now that they've linked Narrow to the Hierarchs of the Horn Society, so they've definitely put the daemons are, you know, it goes the demons with us, the daemons with the Horn Society, and the devils with the Scarlet Brotherhood. They've each got one of the alignment aspects of evil, or one of the different types of, you know, those, you know, underworld creatures. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 187, and the beginning of chapter 17. This is paragraph 1. Lord of Pain danced in glee through the great halls of his palace in Doraka. Those who served us hid from his sight, lest he suddenly changed his mood and punish those who viewed his gloating cavort. Uz laughed and jeered and pranced, knowing the fear these actions evoked in his minions, and the feelings doubled his joy. Fonkin, Frightface, foul fool, you are not but my own tool, he called, mimicking children's rhymes as he pranced and stepped to his own ditty. After a time, though, Uz tired of his vaunting. It was gladsome to his vile heart, but enough. There was much yet to do. Break. All right, so right here we see Uz prancing around like, you know, a demonic little child. And that fits in with not only his character, but kind of this petty childishness that almost all of the evil characters see. And, you know, I've been commenting on that, but I really wanted to say that is, maybe I just was criticizing the narrow business, but again, I really wish that Gygax did the evil characters a little fuller and not so much exactly like each other. I don't think there's a reason why they all have to be, you know, willing to turn on each other or, you know, act like spoiled children or crazy children. And, you know, that's, I could see that for Uz, you know. But he's really kind of done the same characteristics for everybody. Everybody who's evil, they all will cower and they will all back down if there's a greater force set up against them. And then they'll, you know, they'll try to dominate if they're, you know, if they're not. Now, I'd say, yeah, that can be the characteristics of evil characters. But instead, I wouldn't like it to be the characteristic of almost every evil character that's, you know, popped up seems to act a lot like this. Now, the other thing is, here we have that word Fonkin again is brought up. So, you know, it's again that insult that Evelie made Gord aware of when she called him a Fonkin back in Saga of Old City. And, of course, the famous character Fonkin Hottie Peak, both his names are put down. So, all right, I'm going to restart. It's page 187 in the third paragraph. Uz sent forth a thought, attend me instantly. Then he sprawled his corpulent bulk upon his chair of bones and skulls and awaited the coming of those who served him. Lord of ancient evil, your servants attend their master, said a woman of indeterminate years, who wore vestments of rust red trimmed in black. In her hand was an ebon staff bound with silver, and topped with a silver-set skull, an object indicating her status as high priestess. Six heads bowed before him. You are the greater six, and as my right hand, you will be the first to know of my coming triumph. Uz said in a gloating tone. As he spoke, a half-dozen clerics lifted their bowed heads and stood quietly with rapt attention. They knew the Cambion was about to relate something of unusual importance, for his antics were known throughout the nightmarish palace. My plan is nearing fruition, Uz boomed. Far to the south, the weaklings have gotten enough courage to band together. They're going to battle with a host of the stinking Brotherhood. Of course, Uz referred to the scarlet-clad servants of regimented hell his listeners knew, and the two will neutralize each other. There was a soft murmur of pleasure from the listeners, for they anticipated ill for the kingdom of Furiandi and the arch-clerisy of Valuna, two states who constantly sought the downfall of their master, and of themselves as well. Happy as that news is, Uz purred, scratching his great belly and ignoring their minor interruptions of his speaking, I have better word. At this, the six froze into silence and attention once again. Molag is in confusion. Three of the Hierarchs are missing, my spies tell me, and there are reports of some terrible loss somewhere. But even this is not the best news. May the plans of our ancient master always prevail, the entourage intoned in unison. Beaming with malign pleasure, the great Cambion raised his voice to a triumphant basso that filled the ghastly throne room. My tools now come near. With them they bear the second key, the portion of the artifact of all evil, most dear to the dung lump who must forever sleep. Once that portion is safe in my hands, never will I allow it from my grasp. It will make us more powerful. It will bend the abyss to my will, for as long as the adder artifact remains separate, never will the others be able to force their wretched little plans upon me, upon the abyss, upon the only true evil. Our Lord of all evil speaks. We hear and accept, the Sikh said in ritual response to the utterances of the Cambion. All right, break. The jump back, Chris put up the map here showing Krablesthorpe. And I'm trying to see, we see Molag, and then if you follow this road right there, it leads down to that Krablesthorpe, which is supposed to be just 20 miles from where this banishment spell was cast. But
it looks like it's in the Horn Society, and I think that's a good thing.
You think that's correct, that it's in the Horn Society?
I don't know. I mean, on the map, I think it is.
Well, on the map, it definitely looks. I mean, I think, doesn't the red line besides the border also trace the Vang River?
Yeah, I thought that was the Vang, the red line.
Yeah, because there's Boulder Ford. So anyway, Gleed is ambushed near Boulder Ford. And that ambush is on the side of the Furiundi. And then the Hierarchs are on the other side. So, no, I don't think that Krablesthorpe is in the right place at all.
So you think it's actually in Furiundi?
I think it's in Furiundi, somewhere near Boulder Ford. Probably, I don't know which direction, but I don't see why it would be down in this position. And I think that's the Retensa down there. Even if 12 miles a hex, that's something like, 60 miles from Boulder Ford. I don't think that's correct. I think, now this is a post-war map, but I don't think it can be much more than, 20 or so miles from, 20 or so miles from where Melf and Gord and the others dispelled Neryl. So I think that's rather in Furiundi itself.
Yeah, because as far as we know, Gord and the party never went into the Horn Society lands.
Yeah, and I mean, okay. It just doesn't make sense because they were fleeing from the black cloud that was emanating from, east of the Vang when they had ambushed Gleed west of the Vang in Furiundi lands. All right, what did I want to... Now, this section we just read through right here, one of the things is that there's a lot of use of, various talk about true evil and evil that is like lawful evil and stuff, but when you're using it here, they definitely do mean Gygax started using the alignments as actual philosophies within the within the setting, not just game terms. So like when Uz is saying things about true evil and before they were recognizing the various alignments, then it was really speaking about like a philosophy of lawful neutral, chaotic good, and those were actually being used in the campaign here as not just like we'd say this is a game term, But no, it's actually, there is something about that they call chaotic good. There is something they call lawful neutral. And those are, paths kind of to follow. All right. And then Chris has just put up that Elohim, Extor, Maldisa, and Adonai are only mentioned on that one page in this book, 186. So there, it's unknown what or who they are. Now, everyone else mentioned in that section was an actual deity, including Rexphalus, the Cat Lord, who is mentioned elsewhere. So, you know, we have here, in what I just read, here is us calling Tharizdun dung lump. We're seeing that us, even though he's shown as a childish and foolish, he's actually more sensible in this, rather than the others who are being very risky with these various artifacts, that if they do free Tharizdun, now it looks like the Scarlet Brotherhood wants to free Tharizdun, and Nerl, who is supposedly leading the Hierarchs, wants to free Tharizdun. So, I'm a little surprised. I did think that they didn't want to free him, but here, Gygax is having two of the largest groups of organized evil who do want to free him, free Tharizdun. All right. I'm going to restart here. It's page 188. It is the third paragraph from the bottom. Our Lord of all evil speaks. We hear and accept the six said in ritual response to the utterances of the Cambion. Listen now, for I have instructions for each of you. So saying, Uz wrapped a brazen tube beside his throne, and the horny knuckles of the demonling caused the cylinder to shudder with a mournful bell tone. A pair of dretch swung the chamber doors apart, and a huge Nabasu, wings flared, strode 3 paces into the room. The demon bent its knee and asked in a rasping voice, "Your wish, Eldritch Lord." "Fetch the ambassador of the Drow here at once," Uz said. The man-eating demon bowed, backed from the throne room, and the bronze valves were shut again by the dretch servants. Uz smiled at his trusted lieutenants, his mouth full of pointed teeth, seeming to split his face in half as he did so, then continued his instructions. "Mole, you are assigned to work with Olive of my lesser six. You are to take a force of Buhir and Nanas. You will command them, my regiment of Black Death, and a company of Drow. You are to invade the lands of the Hierarchs, raise the wild Uraz and free Reavers there, and march on Molag. I want my city back." All right, break. So he's going to have his regiment of Black Death, which is going to be formed. Buhir are, I guess, bugbears, and the Nanez, I'm not sure offhand which they are. The Uraz are orcs, so he's using, I believe, the Flan names for all of them. And I'm not sure if, with his other being Yggdrasil, if his human half isn't actually Flannish. All right. So, as is known, Molag was taken over by the Hierarchs back when Uz was imprisoned. And there are, Chris has put up his dretch servants, exactly the kind of thing that Uz loves, very downtrodden looking demon. And they're the kind of servants that Uz likes having around him. It is mentioned that Nabasu demon is a much, much stronger demon. And again, that is another servant of Uz. So we have two of the one of the greater six serving Uz, named Mole, and one of the lesser six being named Olive. All right. let's see where we're at. There's enough. I'm going to start again right here. It's page 189 and the fourth paragraph. Short, long-nosed mage stepped forward a pace. Alden replied, "I hear and obey, ancient lord." As he said this, a pretty woman wearing the garments of a cleric of Uz came from a curtained alcove nearby and stood one pace behind Mole, likewise making obeisance. "Good," the Cambion said as he motioned for a tall old crone wearing a black robe covered with magical sigils to join Mole and Olive. "Your second will be Althea, and she shall have the illusion worker called Jumper at her back as well. General Sindel knows my plan, and he will inform you of it. Go at once. You must begin your march immediately. Do not fail." As the four were departing, Uz pointed to yet another of his greater six. Herman Mindbender, a turban-back Lunai, bowed deeply. "Take the wizard Null, and go amongst the rulers of the bandit kingdoms. Give them heart. Tell them I, Uz, come to their aid. Renegade nomads and a host of others are ripe for war. Pass through the Felreeve forest on your way. Bring them south with you. Slay the servants of the horns. Make certain that the petty lords understand and invade the enemy after they are driven out." "Yes, ancient one. We will cross the Retensa and harry the enemy all the way to Molag, or I am nothing," said the swarthy illusionist, with hard arrogance in his voice. "Exactly," said the green-eyed creature who sat on the throne above him. "Ulshur Skull and Bones will make a footstool here." Null, a nondescript man, had joined Kerman during the course of the instruction from Uz, but now backed from the chamber and were gone. Half of the greater six remained, and Uz now addressed them, calling in the remaining lessers as he did so. All right, I'm going to end here for the night. There we have Nabisou, Major Demon, the demon that Chris has posted on the Fiction Text channel here. Both creatures, the Dretch and the Nabisou, are from Monster Manual 2. But this is a pretty powerful, powerful creature right here. Although I'm not sure about the hit dice or the hit points. It says 5 plus 2 and 20. So I'm not sure how powerful it actually is. High intelligence, great cunning, chaotic evil, 7 feet tall. Three attacks, 2-8, 2-8, 3-12. Special attacks and special defenses. A varied magic resistance. So it's a pretty powerful demonic character, but not super, super powerful. Those are the kind of creatures which are demons that are now serving us. So we get here a whole bunch of different names for the lesser and the greater of Uz's servants. And we also have this General Sindel, who I'm not sure where he fits in, but he just seems to be leading of the different, at least one part of Uz's armies. All right. I'm going to end it here. We're on page 190, and we're still making our way through an Uz chapter, and we're actually getting quite a bit of different lore in this chapter. I mean, we pretty much know what Uz is like. He's not, I think, a very surprising character, but we are learning more about the structure. Now, they changed some things, I think they ended up calling these people the Boneheart in the second edition material, in the Sargon era. But right now, they're just the greater and lesser. And now, if there was even a secret group, and that group was composed of, I believe, Obmi and Keek and Gleed and three others, And they were this secret group that no one knew about. So Uz has all these various, these various servants and things. Now, I think you know, that a lot of them are. We've heard now about the high priestess of Uz. She's this, you know, the cleric who's wearing the garments of Uz. We've heard about the various magicians and illusionists. And so Uz likes to have a very varied group, which, you know, really makes sense because, you know, as was pointed out earlier, these magic users, cleric and magician, druid and illusionist, they work well adding one strength to another. All right, well, it's 7 o'clock, and I'm going to be ending it for tonight. I'm calling up Craig and kicking him out.
Good night.
Good night, Chris. And I will be back tomorrow.